Today on Edge Effects.
You know, I just think we have to change that culture. We have to recognize our responsibility to the world, our responsibility as a citizen. That doesn't mean that you don't do curiosity-based research, because it's not like I set out to save the world or do environmental justice or protect people. It was literally, you know, this is like, oh, what a colorful frog. And the next thing I know, I'm talking about, you know, breast cancer.
Agricultural scientist Kate Avancic sits down with Tyrone Hayes, professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley. They discuss toxicology, environmental health, and structures of power in the sciences and the academy at large.
Thanks again for agreeing to meet with us. I just wanted to start with an introductory about your childhood. Tell us about a little bit about your childhood and why frogs?
I grew up in South Carolina, and the why frogs, I can't really answer. I've always been interested in wildlife in general, but especially frogs. I think in particular the accessibility, the metamorphosis, watching tadpoles turn into frogs, and the questions around both the developmental processes that have to happen, that have to occur for that to happen, the physiological challenges of living in water and on land. And it's one of the things that makes amphibians ideal for the kind of work that I do, because of that vulnerability and the dependence on hormones and the that they absorb chemicals through the skin, both from the water and in the air, that their food source is a target for chemicals like insecticides.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about how your research motivations have changed over the years? I know it's a living, breathing thing, your research. So
yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Underlying my interest is still in developmental endocrinology, or the role of hormones in development in amphibians. And I guess my involvement with atrazine and endocrine disruptors has sort of shifted me more towards eco-epidemiology or toxicology or something like that. But my interests are still in how these chemicals can alter hormones and then change developmental trajectories. There's still a lot of basic science questions that, for example, we don't understand. Like, for example, nobody knows what hormone or what gene or what chemical tells you to make sperm versus egg. And now we have a chemical that when male frogs are exposed, they get the wrong signal and they make the wrong germ cells. So that's still a very basic developmental endocrinology question with the unfortunate tool that we can use to try to address that.
Mm-hmm. Why do you suspect that there is that gap in the knowledge?
I think certainly people have been interested, but simply not had the tools to use in the laboratory to try to address that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we now have a really interesting model where males grow the wrong things, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a really unique place where we can look at environment and hormones and genes and gene regulation. And those are the same kinds of questions that were exciting to me when I was a kid. Just now, we've altered our environment so much that you can't really study environmental regulation of development without talking about the things we've done, whether it's climate change or whether it's transporting species around, invasive species carrying new diseases, or global exposure to chemicals like atrazine.
Can you tell us a little bit about your research with atrazine? And I know also you've worked in the past with agribusiness,
mm-hmm.
And kind of your relationship there and how that's evolved over the years.
Yeah, I was contracted, in about 1997 to do a literature review of atrazine and its potential as an endocrine disruptor in amphibians was my part of the work that I was challenged with. And then after that, I was funded starting in 1998 to do research on atrazine to determine its effects on amphibians, potential effects as an endocrine disruptor. And the contract was from the manufacturer. They were Novartis at the time. And we discovered that atrazine inhibited growth of the voice box or the larynx, indicating that it was somehow reducing testosterone availability to exposed males. And we subsequently discovered that it also caused feminization. It caused either males to grow ovaries or, in some species, males to grow eggs instead of sperm in their testes. And we later showed that there are behavioral effects, negative impairments of male sexual behavior also associated with atrazine. And the company, after the first study, pulled back their funding and eventually hired other people to try to negate our proof that our work was wrong somehow, and eventually resorted into other types of harassment that continued up until about a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. In toxicology, a major reoccurring argument is that in vitro studies don't translate to human toxicology. How do you address these arguments? And can you just tell us how these findings in frogs, what they mean for people, what the translation is?
Well, I really take an integrative approach to science, meaning that doing things in a laboratory under control conditions allows you to pinpoint if a chemical is causing a problem. So in my animals, the difference between when we get hermaphrodites, we know that those are animals that are exposed to atrazine and the controls weren't. So we know what the critical factor is. That doesn't tell you if it happens in the real world. So then we do correlational studies in the real world where we measure atrazine levels in the environment and compare that to whether or not we see similarly malformed animals in the field. And studies in the lab aren't real, but the studies in the real world aren't controlled. And so having that combination helps you understand better. Also doing in vitro studies where we're looking at, let's say, metabolism, we're looking at binding to the receptor, we're looking at what genes are being turned on and off. That also helps you pinpoint what the exact mechanism is, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what a chemical could do in the whole organism, but it tells you what it does on that specific tissue. And that gives you a key as to what to look for, whether you want to move your studies on to rats or to humans, because we know that there's a common mechanism for atrazine, for example, the induction of aromatase and inappropriate synthesis of estrogen. So we would look for other effects in humans that we know would be due to that same mechanism, whether it's gastroesthesis or, you know, genital malformation. So so frogs, for example, don't have external genitalia. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't look for an effect on external genitalia, but you notice a common underlying mechanism that would affect the gonads in the frog, and that would explain the effects that you find in humans. And oftentimes the manufacturer, for example, will argue, well, they're rat studies, so they're not directly applicable to humans. I don't know why else we would do rat studies if we aren't using them as a model to make predictions about humans. And you have to consider at the same time you can't do experiments on humans. So you can only do correlational epidemiological work. It's difficult to show cause and effect. But when you have a laboratory model that produces that same effect under control conditions or produces an effect via a mechanism that would explain both types of endpoints, then I think you have a much stronger case.
Is it fair to characterize it as a roadmap for studies on humans, or is it not that simple?
I guess you could. I don't know that I think of it that way, but I think one of the things I think you have to do is to look at all the data in context, and not to look at one little study or studies only on amphibians or studies only on rats. You build a much bigger case when you have physiological measurements that can all be explained by a common mechanism, and you see them across the vertebrate. So you could argue that, as the company did, oh, my lab did something wrong, or you should add a larger sample size. But when you put together 22 scientists from 12 different countries who are getting the same result, you can't argue that they independently all did something wrong. In fact, even if you argue that there's a flaw in my experimental design, it makes the case even stronger that, oh, according to the company, all these things I screwed up, and I still got this answer.
Right, even with the flaw, yeah. You saw the same rank. Interesting. So my next question is about the communities impacted mm-hmm. by your work. Are some communities better able to mitigate the risks of chemical exposures than others? And can you talk a little bit about your work with those communities?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably very clear that if you're from an affluent community, you have, one, greater access to information, you have greater access to education, to better schools, you have greater access to organic local produce. I mean, I can tell you a story. You have access to the money to, you know, get better health care, and you're less likely to work in an area where you're directly exposed to chemicals or to other hazards, as opposed to immigrant or low-income or ethnic minority communities. And part of the problem is so then you have a better environment, usually, and you have better access to health care, so you keep better track of your health. Like the woman was pointing out in the audience today that, you know, I made the statement that, and if you read all the papers, it says a risk factor for PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome, is being white. It is more common in Caucasians. And she said, no, it's just not diagnosed. Or it's diagnosed as diabetes, which is happens subsequent to the PCOS. So they're diagnosing it when it's further along, mm-hmm. as opposed to in the Caucasian community. So part of the problem is that as a low-income or minority or immigrant community, you have more hazards in the environment. You have less access to information and healthcare. And another part of the problem is maybe you don't even recognize that there's a problem. And an example I always use for that is my father did floor covering. And I remember he would come home from work with his hair white and say, oh, look how work made me old. And it's because he was sanding asbestos. And his uncles that all taught him to trade all died by 40. But if all you know is, oh, men die at 40, you don't even realize that there's a problem. And so if in addition there's a language barrier and you're living in a community like the agricultural community and people die at 50, you don't know that there's anything wrong. That's just when people die. So part of the problem is you don't even recognize necessarily that there's a problem because your frame of reference is everybody's going through the same thing. You know, everybody has, you know, this many miscarriages, or everybody, you don't realize that you're in that situation. And even if you do, if you think about the agricultural community, agriculture workers, 90% being, even if you're documented, probably a significant number of people that you know aren't. So even if you recognize there's a problem, you're not going to complain. Mm-hmm. You're not going to bring trouble on your whole community. So there are a lot of things that go into, I think, creating those health disparities. Mm-hmm. I had an experience where Marin County, which is a fairly affluent county in California, they asked me to come testify because there was light brown apple moth and they were going to fly over and drop pheromones on the, you know. And not that the insect pheromones were really a risk to human health, but I think the idea of a plane flying over and spraying something just, you know, the community had this big hearing. And, you know, I couldn't testify that it was dangerous. But one of the reasons I went was to say, look, one county over is an agriculture county, and if you were as active in protecting everybody, then nobody would even think of flying over and dropping something on you, right? But it takes a threat to your community when these other communities really are being sprayed with things that are quite harmful.
Mm-hmm. So that begs the question: in academia, with academic findings, they're often argued as really inaccessible to the general public. How do you, one, tackle that? And two, what would your advice be to the young academics in this room right now that want to translate their findings?
Well, I think we have to change the culture of the ivory tower, because it's not just many scientists. I think I'm probably criticized for speaking out and for, quote, being an advocate. But if you're not doing it, then you're asking people who aren't the experts, who may or may not have access to your primary work, who may or may not be able to explain the primary literature, to do that job for you. And I would argue for my kids, for my neighbors. But it's not only is it often not positive, but it can negatively impact the career. And I think that, you know, if I didn't, you know, I make jokes about having tenure so I could do what I want, but it's a reality. I can do and say things now that I couldn't have done and said 20 years ago, because I don't have to fear not being promoted or, you know, not getting offered tenure. And I can't prove it, but I would guess, had this all went down before I got tenure, I would guess I'd be looking for a job, you know. And, you know, I've had it happen to colleagues of mine. And, you know, I think we really have to go beyond. I have so many colleagues that, you know, you go to visit their office and they give you these books. I'm like, why are we trading these books and papers with each other? Like, you know, it's just, I won't call any names, but some of them have lots of books. And nobody reads them except, you know, these other people in the ivory tower. And you know, I just think we have to change that culture, and we have to recognize our responsibility to the world, our responsibility as a citizen. Like I said, more than just a little boy who likes frogs. And that doesn't mean that you don't do curiosity-based research, and that's why I tell the story exactly as it happened, because it's not like I set out to save the world or do environmental justice or protect people. It was literally, you know, this like, oh, what a colorful frog. You know? And the next thing I know, I'm talking about, you know, breast cancer.
Right. You said today in your talk that your former advisor mm-hmm. once said, don't be an advocate, let the science speak for itself. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk a little bit more about that?
I think it's probably more general sentiment, especially, well, maybe not even just an older faculty, but, you know, I've definitely been told by my dean that they pay lip service to, yeah, we care about your public outreach, but I've been told, yeah, we don't really care about this. And if you do too much of it, it's not only deemed that, you know, you're spending too much of your time, you know, giving talks that don't count, so to speak. But then there's also this idea that if you're an advocate, that you somehow you're biased, which is, you know, BS. I mean, we're biased in terms of how we choose what to study and how far we decide to go and where we decide to publish it. And nobody writes a grant going, gee, I hope I don't find anything interesting. Right? So because your motivation might be to understand the implications of, for example, something like atrazine, doesn't mean that somehow you're now doing bad science any more so than you would doctor your science to get another. I mean, maybe there are people who do that. I don't know. Right? But I don't know that a motivation to actually have a positive impact on policy is any more motivation to do bad science or to twist your science. And it certainly has led me to, because it got a lot of attention and because it was so interesting and because it was so exciting, then of course I'd follow it like I'd follow anything else. And I've definitely dropped other projects or other things off because this pathway was more interesting and was more productive. But yeah, that's the bias could have been that I got a grant to do something else, and so I went down that road. Right?
Sure. So along the same lines of politically charged topics that are worth further investigation and advocacy, how do you steer clear of advocacy battles that seek to use their results for their cause? Kind of the other side of the coin.
I don't know how to answer that question. Because, you know, once something's public, I see incredible things on Facebook sometimes, and I'm like, I never said that. You know, I'll see an interview that I did, for example, and there's a group that circulates this thing that claims that I've said that the government purposely puts chemicals in the water to turn black men gay to destroy the black race. I'm like, when did I ever say that? And, you know, and every now and then, I've learned now, you don't engage these kinds of things over Facebook. Every now and then I'll say, no, I never said that. Yeah, it never comes out pretty in the end. So, there's no way to prevent that. Especially now, I mean, you know, the internet's both incredible for spreading information. Things spread really fast. It's also incredible for spreading misinformation. Or, you know, the times I've been linked to the vaccination thing. And I'm like, no, don't like attach me to that. What's this other thing that people talk about? Chemtrails. I didn't even know what that was. Do you know what this is?
No, I'm not.
There's this whole theory that the government puts something in commercial airlines that alters the atmosphere. It's a big thing that lots of people follow. And photographs and all kinds. And I'm like, I think because parts of my story are so unbelievable that then there are other unbelievable stories that really are not believable, but people can't really tell the difference. You know, like if I say, and there really is, that like this thing's supposed to be happening with the EPA and the company has this kind of influence over the EPA, and somebody else says, and this thing's going on with vaccines, but like people don't know how to separate those things. And in part because people don't have access to the primary literature. The vaccine paper was retracted. The guy faked the data. But if you don't have access to the primary literature, you don't know that. And there's still people who follow that. And I've gotten in these discussions on Facebook, you know, and then they'll turn it like, after what happened to you, how can you not see that there are other conspiracies out there? And I'm like, oh. Or occasionally, I don't want to say where, but occasionally I get invitations to things and I'm side by side with somebody and I'm like, oh, wow. I gave a talk once at... It's kind of like an institute where you go to cleanse yourself or sort of the health, like a spa for, you know.
Okay.
And so I was invited to give a talk. And also this guy who was a medical doctor who had his license taken away in Europe because he claims that cancer is a fungus that can be cured with baking soda. And I'm like, okay, wait, I'm giving a keynote side by side with this guy, you know. And so they, you know, and part of his was like, oh, doctors don't want you to know that because they make so much money on cancer and that's why they're trying to shut me down. And, you know, I'm saying, oh, and the company tried to shut me. I'm like, wait, I sound just like this guy. Right? And then you can understand how somebody who's not a scientist, who doesn't have access to the literature, who doesn't know how to evaluate, could be confused about, because there's some similarities in the claims, right? But not to mention this guy was an all-around nasty, nasty person. But, I mean, who... talked about working somewhere, I forget now, but in a country, like a poor country where he would trade his medical advice and things for time with this person's wife and things. Like those are the kinds of things he talked about at dinner.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I hope you can see now that we're two different sets of people. Anyway.
speaking of information sharing and potentially misinformation, I have a question about your thoughts on peer-reviewed versus industry monographs in terms of informing policy.
I think, you know, without being judgmental, I think that industry scientists who are actually working for the industry, you know, you have to realize that their job is to make money and to not lose money, and having had that experience with this particular company, in some cases that involves doing things that I think are being asked to do things that are unethical, which is why I left the company. And others, it depends on where how you draw the line of what's ethical or not. In others, it's designing experiments that won't show anything. So they specifically would set out to design an experiment so they could say, we tested this chemical, it did nothing. I'm like, yeah, but you put it in a design.
Sure.
That, you know. And so I think you have to realize that when you're looking at industry studies. You have to realize that the ones that are being published are the ones that they selectively decide to publish and how they selectively decide to publish them and how they decide to represent them. Because they're making money. And that's their job. And one way to look at it is, I remember I met Johnny Cochran once when we were right in the middle of all this. And, you know, part of his job, if he's defending somebody, is part of the job is just to confuse, you know, to bring up evidence and to get the jury confused so that they can't make a decision. And to some extent, that's what industry is doing with atrazine. They're doing studies and saying, oh, it can't be replicated. And in some cases, they're outright lying, right? In other cases, you know, this statement you'll see from Syngenta all the time that we have over 6,000 studies that shows that atrazine is safe. Where are these 6,000 studies? They're certainly not in the peer-reviewed published literature, but they may very well have 6,000 little things that they call studies. Doesn't mean that they've done anything to show that my work or other people's work isn't valid, right? But then the public gets confused, like, well, there's 6,000 studies to Hayes's 3 or whatever. In the same way they use this term, good laboratory practices. And it's NIH, I believe, set of standards for how you maintain samples for, you know, chain of custody. But when they say Hayes doesn't operate under GLP, to the layperson, it's like, oh, Hayes doesn't use good laboratory. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean that I have bad laboratory practices. It just means that I'm not, and I believe it's an NIH set of standards, it's that my lab doesn't operate on that type of chain of custody. That doesn't mean that samples get lost and are laying around. But if you're a layperson, you don't know that.
Right. And it just seems like that's, again, another barrier that keeps the science and the literature away from just another barrier to understanding.
Well, and it's also a lack of commitment from academics. So, for example, let's see. How can I say this without being offensive? So, for example, when the EPA has their hearings, I've presented twice. So anybody can go, right? You don't even have to work on atrazine. You can say, I want 10 minutes to talk about atrazine, and you can go to the hearing. I am one of the few independent or academic scientists that go. And there's obviously lots and lots of people working on atrazine, but you don't get credit for it. You're not going to pay yourself to fly to D.C. Whereas industry will fly 12 scientists. You know, that are on their payroll. And whereas when I sign in, you know, you have to sign in if you're going to present, the university's position is you're representing yourself, not the university. So I can't sign in with my credentials. I just sign in as Tyrone Hayes. These guys, I can tell you, it's public record. You can go look it up. They all sign in with their university. So if you look at the record, it looks like 10 different universities and some guy named Tyrone. Because I'm doing what I'm supposed to.
Their university meaning where they receive their credentials.
And where they're working.
Current.
Yeah. So they'll you know, Jim Carr, Texas Tech, or John Giese, Michigan State, Keith Solomon, University of Guelph. And I'm just Tyrone.
That's because that's linked to their funding.
No, you're still not supposed to do it. Doesn't matter where I'm funded. If I'm here to give a talk now, I don't represent the University of California. I represent myself. You know, anytime you speak or provide testimony. And that dictates how you sign in to this public document. Or it's just like if you have a number of people studying atrazine as academics, they simply don't advocate and don't do. Whereas the company is paying people, lobbyists and things, to push their science. So if I'm saying I'm not going to be an advocate, and I'm going to let the science speak for itself. They've got lobbyists and scientists and ghostwriters that they're paying to speak for the other side. And to be honest, I think many people just wouldn't want to end up in a situation like I was in because they will not stop because that's their bread and butter. They will not. As long as I'm doing it, you can bet they're doing something.
That's so interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about this, the ivory tower. Mm-hmm. Maybe because of where I am in my career and feeling disheartened by the funding opportunities.
Yeah.
And really feeling, in my current research, I'm so lucky to not have to be, I really feel like the funding is coming from a good place and the research, I'm not being pulled in either direction. But that's not always the case. And how do we navigate that? And, you know, what sorts of missed opportunities are there in research because of that?
I wish I had the answer, but things certainly look bleak. I mean, the generation before me, it was, you know, NSF supported careers. You know, my professor just got started and he got one NSF grant after another. And those days aren't around anymore. So you're sitting on an NSF panel going, okay, do I give this huge amount of money to the professor who you know is going to be productive, who's 30 years into his career because you know he's going to, you know, or do I take that money and give it to somebody who's brand new to get that opportunity? And you know, how you balance those things, I think, is very difficult for NSF, certainly. NIH, probably the same thing. And so when I first came out, you were encouraged to diversify your portfolio to make sure, you know, basically you were, as soon as you were done writing one grant, you were writing the next one. And, I mean, you could see the long list of sources that I've been funded by. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I got involved with Syngenta. I thought, okay, this is one other avenue. And, you know, at the time I was brand new assistant professor. I was 24 years ago, since I was 25. And again, it's a lot of money. I mean, in addition to the grant, that wasn't a lot of money. But in addition to the grant, I got paid as a consultant, like $1,000 a day, like fresh out of graduate. Like literally, if I emailed the company and said, hey, I thought about atrophy today, I get a check in the mail for $1,000. That's how they operate, because then you get hooked on this, you know, hey, I need another $50,000 for the lab, and it's pretty tempting. And I was around people who were older than me who that had been their whole careers. And they had, you know, John Giese, for example, he was at Michigan State. He had a former student that was a vice president of Syngenta. He just, you know, his whole career, he was set, you know. And I could have been set in the sense that once I knew that there was bad information, for all the millions that they spent trying to destroy me, that money could have all been in my pocket. So, I mean, for some people, I would think that's very tempting, especially in this time. And on the other hand, too, there's no real source of, well, I mean, you would know from Karasoff's lab, there's no increasingly less money to do that. EPA doesn't pay for screening or testing or doing research. So most of the money, if you're going to do that kind of work, will come from industry. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough call. I don't envy young people. I mean, even my colleagues now, I have so many colleagues whose grants have run out. And in my case, I have private funding and I have an endowment. So not that I don't have to worry, but I know I have a base sum of money that I'm going to have until I retire. But that's very rare.
Yeah, but I can only imagine being fresh out of graduate school and having that sort of opportunity in front of you.
Yeah.
Is really enticing. Sure.
And the challenges, I think, with funding become even more difficult. Because when you're first starting your lab, you're going to have a startup fund, right? So you have some money, you have a few years to apply. But then after that, and in fact, tenure, when people come up for tenure now, it's almost like the first grant doesn't count. They're looking for your ability to get the second grant. Because that means that you hooked an agency or you did enough work to. Because the first one you're getting the benefit of the doubt grant, right? It's the second one that shows that you can be productive and get the second grant. And so that one is the one that if you don't get, because see, by now, when you're on the second grant, you've got a whole lab. And it's not just you that you have to take care of. You have graduate students. And I know graduate students, for example, who have their own funding, but they're sitting around in the lab because there's no funds.
So how do we protect scientific integrity?
So what I've been watching for the last couple of months, I have no idea. I hate to be pessimistic, but I things look pretty bleak to me. And I would still say, yeah, I still say you have to diversify. You have to be a strong. I've had, for example, I've had other private funding, some from non-government organizations, some from a water company funded me for a while. And he just said, look, I just want to know if there's something bad in the water. You know, I'm providing water to my customers. I just want to fund the research so that we know about it. And there was no, I want this outcome. It was just do your work. But, you know, my other interactions with Novartis weren't like that. They wanted a particular answer. They wanted a particular presentation.
I'm looking at you with a furrowed brow and biting my lip because that is so disheartening. But we must move onward. And part of moving onward is through science communication and storytelling. And you are such a beautiful storyteller. I mean, we saw it today here and all over the internet too. I mean, you could see really wonderful accounts of your research and you really put some wonderful context, into all of your work. And so I just want to know, what are your plans and aspirations with writing some non-academic stuff?
Well,
where's your book?
Every other semester, I take off every other spring to write that book. And then I end up going to Wisconsin, going to Florida, because then I go, oh, okay, I don't have to teach it. So I thought about this long and hard, that I didn't want to write one of those books that people pass around to each other, that I really wanted to write something that academics would pick up. What I've written is, in fact, I just had a friend reading parts of it yesterday. What I've written is more sort of autobiographical, but also talks about the science. It's obviously been a big part of, you know, 20 years out of my 50 on this planet. And so the hope is that academics would read it, and there are lots of things that are there about, for example, being a black scientist and some of the different experiences that you have in doing that, because it's a very different experience. So hopefully there's enough of the science in there and also enough of the story. And I think a large part of the story, to be honest, a large part of what happened with Syngenta and me really has to do with that persona. And we really sort of grew together. And if you look at their handwritten, like I used to joke that they have meetings on how to piss off a black person. If you look at their notes, they literally did. So they hired professionals to come in and say, you know, this thing. And they played on things like, or tried to anyway, they played on things like that I didn't fit in. So they played on this sort of imposter syndrome that a lot of minorities and women experience, that like, oh, you know, I don't quite fit in here. And so they played on that in the way that I would deliver a talk at a scientific meeting. But that's one of the things that made me go, you know, screw all that. You know, here's my outline. I'm just going to tell a story just like I would if I were sitting at home with my folks. And so they got the opposite response, was the more they tried to tell me, you know, I would get emails from them, things like, you're not a scientist, you're an entertainer, you're a preacher. Everybody's saying you're an entertaining fool. Trying to make me think like, oh my God, I'm not. They would make comments about, you know, my sexuality, like as if I was going to get upset. You know, so the more they said it, then the more I expressed who I was, rather than trying to, you know. And at one point I said to them, I could. I went to Harvard. I could sit back and use big vocabulary and wear my Harvard jacket and my tweed suit. But I don't have to do that. I could do it my way, and it's even better. And I think if I weren't, again, probably if I were younger, and probably if I didn't have tenure, and probably if I weren't more confident in myself, then I think that would happen. I think they've done the same thing to, if you think about who are the other big environmentalists kind of in this area, Steele Colburn, Sandra Steingraber, Rachel Carson, and I think too that they were all sort of attacked as being women and being too, you know, nurturing and caring and not being a scientist and not fitting in. I think there was that same kind of approach to how those scientists were treated in this whole thing as well.
I saw that the majority of your lab is comprised of women. Mm-hmm. And as a woman in science, I'm really interested in hearing about your approach and your philosophy toward empowerment of women in science.
You know, I don't know. You know, my class, my lecture course has always been 75 to 80% female. And most, I think I've probably accepted every male that's applied to the lab. And for a while, most of my graduate students were male. And that used to bug me because I had like 5 male graduate students and like, you know, 7 out of 9 undergraduates were female. And like, why was it? I mean, now my last 1, 2, 3, 4 graduate students have been women. And 2 of the 3 that I have coming in are women. And people also often ask, how do I recruit? And I don't. I think people just come because I have the reputation for having more women, having a lot of ethnic diversity. Specifically, people, when I give talks in the larger courses, people from the Central Valley, people from Salinas, who've actually been, you know, will talk about being sprayed by chemicals when they were working with their parents in the field, have come to work in my laboratory. And that's been a really great experience to have, you know, people who firsthand have experienced some of the things that I talk about, and being able to learn from them as well. I remember one of the most embarrassing things I ever had happen was, this is going off on a tangent, but.
We love tangents.
But I had a speeding ticket, and long story short, I went to argue the ticket, you know, because anyway, my argument always is, you can't prove it was me that you clocked. And often the judges say, were you speeding? I go, yes, but that's not the point. He can't prove that it was me. There were lots of cars speeding. But if the cop doesn't show up, then you get off. So it's worth a few hours off. Anyway, so I'm there, and the first hour is all people who need a translator. And it was all the same story. It was a Hispanic person who, you know, didn't speak English, so the translator had to. And they've been caught driving without a license, and I don't know, the ticket's like $800 or 20 hours of service of labor, something like that. So they were all, it was all the exact same thing. And so I go back, and it was almost like a scene from Seinfeld or something like that. You know, all the stories were exactly the same. They were translated. And so I go back and I'm like, gee, why don't they just get a driver's license? And one of my students, whose brother is not documented, said, you jerk, you can't get a driver's license if you're not documented. And I, you know, it's so different from my experience that I never thought about. And then if you think about it, that was one courtroom on one courthouse on one day. It's basically slave labor. The hours and hours and hours of free, and I don't know what they do. They clean up the highway or whatever the job is they get. And it's all just people trying to get to work. And for how many hours and hours and hours and hours of free labor do we have? And the cop doesn't have to, you don't have to be speeding or anything. They just come over and say, let me see your driver's license. And so they're rounding up like, I don't know how many people a day. And so it's things like that that, you know, but if I had never talked, I mean, I was making fun of this thing. That's an awful thing because it was just, for me, I like couldn't understand. You know, it's almost like let him eat cake or something, right? Like, why don't I just go get a driver's license? And I'm like, oh, you know, and I felt like such a jerk.
Anyway. There's clearly a disproportionate amount of white males that are in positions of power in academia. And how do we navigate that? How do you encourage your students to navigate that differently? How did you navigate that differently? What advice would you give?
That's a hard question. You know, I mean, I have good colleagues. I mean, I've never felt like among my, you know, colleagues in the department, I've never felt. But there are many, many things that happen that I don't quite know how to get around. There are things like, for example, okay, long story short, there are things like, for example, I used to pay literally like 10 times more for my animal space than everybody else.
What's that all about?
And I can tell you, I had a conversation where, you know, I was talking to my dean. I'm like, you know, look at these prices. I'm paying 10 times for the same space as everybody else, literally. And my dean looked at me and said, I lied to you not. He's now president of the University of Michigan. He looked at me and said, well, you can't prove it's because you're black, because you're the only one. And I said, I didn't say it was because I'm black. I just said, why am I being treated this way? Why am I being charged more? But that's the first thing that came into his mind. And certainly you can make the case, I'm the only black faculty. And the way that it happened was, again, it's a little more complicated than this, but basically there's a committee that decides the prices. And so the people on that committee who were like friends with other people who use animals decided to put in another price rate. So while I was paying for to have a frog housed, they were paying for something called an aquatic habitat. So even though it was the same size cage with the same frog in it, what happened was the price for the frog changed over the years and went up and up. And because they were in a committee, they kept their price the same. And I never knew. And so what the reason for that was the committee that I end up on, of course, is the Affirmative Action Committee and the, you know, Scholarship Committee, because those are the things that I care about. And those are the things that maybe I'm uniquely qualified to do. But it means that everybody else is on committees that they care about. And I'm on this committee that they really don't care about, to be honest. And it's not like they're going, yeah, let's screw the black guy. But effectively, that's what happens. Space committee. So if somebody else is deciding how much lab space I get, where I'm there trying to find minority students and push them into their lab. And, you know, so, So there are things like that that, you know, because it's not direct racism, but ultimately that's how it ends up. And the other argument is, so for example, I can tell you too, for the way tenure works is you get asked to review your peer's case, and then you all get together and then you present the case to the department and then they vote on it. So I got asked to review a colleague's tenure case, and it's a group of like three, for the first time, 20 years after I've been in the department. And so I turned to another colleague to say, well, how do I, you know, how do I write this up? How details it has to be? And he says, wait, this is your first one? He's like, gee, I do at least one a year. And the other guy who was in the tenure case was a non-tenured adjunct professor. This is the first time I've been asked in 20 years. And so the argument, though, is, because it's a bit of work, the argument is you're already doing so much and, you know, we don't want to overburden you because you do so much for, you know, the affirmative action and the diversity. I'm like, yeah, but what that means is for 20 years, not only am I at a disadvantage now because I never saw anybody else's case, so I'm on my own writing mine up. I never saw an example. But two, that means that while you're judging me and promoting me, I'm not doing the same for you. It doesn't make me feel like a peer. But again, it's not like anybody said, okay, keep the black guy out. It's like, oh, he's doing all this other stuff. Don't bother. Presumably that's what they're saying. So there are all those things that, you know, I think with young faculty members, you have to warn them and look out for those things, but I don't know how you get around them, right?
Sure.
I mean, if they ask you to be on the committee to review, you know, women in science and the faculty, you're probably not going to say no, because you're unique and qualified to do that. But at the same time, that means they're not asking you to do something else.
No, you're that's going to impact right. you. You're absolutely right. Wow, this is a really, really wonderful and insightful discussion. Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, maybe there aren't so clear-cut answers to approach all of these issues in academia and in all of our natural environments, but surely talking about it and spreading the word is helpful.
Well, and I think we have to keep pushing. You learn something everywhere, whether it's Einstein or Tupac. And I'll tell you one thing I learned. At the 1 year I was the keynote at the National Presbyterians for the Earth Conference. And you can imagine what went through my head. I'm like, oh, geez, like what? I got gonads, like my nails painted. I usually have my eyes done and everything. I'm like, oh. But I went. And the philosophy, the reason for inviting me there was, you know, our creator, according to Presbyterian philosophy, made us stewards of the earth. And so we have to learn about what you're doing so we know how to take care of it. But what really impacted me there was their philosophy was we can't fix anything, but we can stop it from getting worse. And if you think about climate change, even if we stopped everything now, we can't fix it, but we can stop it from getting worse. Extinction, can't make anything come back, but we can stop it from getting worse. And the same thing's true of the chemicals in our environment. We can't fix it, but we can stop it from getting worse. And that's what you have to think. And then if each one of us doesn't stop pushing, then it's going to get all that more worse. Just have to accept that it's never going to get fixed.
Thank you, Tyrone Hayes.
Yeah. Thank you.
That was Kate Avancic, PhD candidate in agronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, speaking with Tyrone Hayes, professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley. You've been listening to Edge Effects, a production of CHE, the Center for Culture, History, and Environment in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today's episode was produced by me, Brian Hamilton, with special thanks to Claire Gervais and Dana Olson. The music you're hearing is by Julian Lynch. In the weeks ahead, look for exciting episodes featuring Jedediah Purdy, William Cronin, and more. Get these sent straight to your computer or mobile device by subscribing to the EdgeFX podcast in the iTunes Store. You can also find us on Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. And as always, keep up with the steady flow of great content about cultural and environmental change across the full sweep of human history at edgeeffects.net.